Dr. W. Israel 7.
We put continuation. We pushed the chairs and whatever we could get hold of towards the wall facing the south, from where the road approached the concentration camp. The atmosphere was electrical. Everybody started to shout, scream, embrace each other. Some people started to sing their national anthems. We reached the top and suddenly we realized that tanks were approaching the camp. They actually came to the camp, to the main entrance. At that moment, I knew my time came to occupy the central. I rushed out and I saw that the Americans came to the camp shortly, and the Austrian police had their arms on their hands and they were disarmed. I couldn't see further what happened because my task was somewhere else. I had to go to the central. Together with Juan de Diego, we occupied the camp and started to receive incoming calls, mostly from outlying areas of the SS. They did not identify themselves. They first asked us to identify our ranks. They thought we were still Germans occupying or SS or occupying the camp, to which we tried to fool them. I even had somebody with a very strong Austrian accent with me as a prisoner, one of our prisoners, who tried to answer the calls in Austrian accent, but they were so cautious, they never wanted to continue speaking because they were unsure whether they were connected to the occupying forces or whether the camp had already formed. What happened now, the organization inside the camp took over. The Americans left with the tanks because it was only a part which reconnaissance, and returned to the headquarters in Linz, where immediately the occupation armed forces were organized. The head of it was Colonel Richard Seibel, who came subsequently immediately to the camp and occupied officially the camp as the part of the American 11th Armored Division of the United States. When Colonel Seibel entered the camp, he first sent somebody to ask for interpreters. Any prisoners who could speak several languages should line up in front of the commander's office. I was among them. I immediately thought I could do both, be in the central telephone office, which obviously afterwards was taken over by the Americans, and so I wouldn't have been needed. We lined up. He asked Colonel Seibel, first stood in front of us. I believe they were about a dozen. And in a very military way, stood to attention and saluted us. Then he went from one to the other, asked what nationality, what languages he spoke. He went through all of them, I must say. Then he came back, and he came back to me, took me out. He said, come with me. And he said he thanked the others, and he told me that from now on, I was going to be his official interpreter in the forces of the 11th Armored Division. I got a special pass, which I still have. And from then on, I went everywhere with the colonel. Consequently, I could see places which, as a prisoner, I never saw. We entered the gas chambers. We entered the crematorium, the bunker, which was the place where special prisoners were murdered and kept separate from others. This gave me also a possibility of swearing after the war, during the trial in Nuremberg, where I was asked as a witness, that the gas chambers existed. As you probably know, Dr. Boot, certain people called, who call themselves revisionists, claim that Holocaust never happened, that the Germans did not kill as many people as they did, that there were never any gas chambers, and that they did not imprison children. All of it is wrong, because I can swear that I have seen all of those, and I witnessed them at the time, either during my imprisonment or at the time of the liberation.
What did you see in the gas chambers and the crematorium?
They were still ashes around. It was in great disorder. The whole machine existed. The gas chambers still existed. Empty cans of cyclone, the gas which was used for gassing, were all around. They were all gathered by the American experts and kept specially, probably sent back to the United States. At this point, may I also say, Dr. Wood, that in my opinion, as a former prisoner who went through almost 4 years of this horrible experience, if you want a definite description by a person who entered the camp at the time of the worst disaster, you should interview Colonel Seibel. I have no doubt that he would give you the most vivid, the most accurate, most dependable description of what he noticed when he entered Camp Mauthausen.
Was there any tendency amongst the prisoners to take revenge on people?
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed there was. Because so many of the capos, so-called capos, which were ordered by the SS during their occupation of the camp, they were so cruel that their cruelty compared easily with that of the SS. So many capos who were prisoners were criminals, and they were in charge of the working parties, and they themselves killed prisoners. After the liberation of the Americans, I believe it was about second or third day, suddenly I heard through contacts I had in the camp, because I was in not far from the office of the commander, that lynching started on the Appellplatz inside the camp. I immediately alerted Colonel Seibel, who, as far as I recall, got up like lightning, ordered immediately the tank available in front of his office to be actioned, ordered his men to open the main door to the camp. I went with him, and he entered the camp with the tank and stopped immediately the lynching. He got out and he asked me to translate in several languages that during the liberation and occupation of the American forces, no indiscriminate lynching, murdering, shooting and killing was allowed. Anybody who did so would immediately be arrested and taken to military court. While we were there, I saw about four or five former capos whom I knew and who were really cruel. They were lying on the ground, their heads either cut off completely or partly cut, blood all over. Some of the bodies were still moving. They were immediately asked to be covered by blankets by SS, by Colonel Seibel. And he ordered that this was a disgraceful act, even though he had certain sympathy with the hatred, understandable hatred of the people who suffered for so long, but he would not allow anybody to take the law in their own hands. No lynching happened after that.
After the war, were you asked to take part in the judicial processes for the conviction of those guilty of crimes?
Yes. First of all, I would like to mention still that due to my knowledge of Russian, I was asked by Colonel Seibel that he would send me by tank, because the situation was not clear yet around, to take by tank to Linz, to the headquarters, and offer my services there for certain translations, because lots of Russian prisoners escaped into the countryside. This is a very, I should say, shameful part, which I regret subsequently what happened. I did not realize it at the time, but according to the Yalta Agreement, the Americans, or all allied forces, agreed to repatriate all the Soviet citizens who were found at that time in any territory of the formerly occupied areas. When I arrived in Linz, I was asked to translate into Russian that message, which would be through megaphones shouted into the woods and on all the roads all around to the villages, that all Soviet citizens should leave the places where they are and should surrender to the Americans, which was a disguise which suddenly, subsequently, I regretted. Because even at that time, I thought, I did not know, having been imprisoned, about this agreement. And I thought at that time that the Russians would be actually taken by the Americans, sent either to a repatriation camp, fed and looked after. As it turned out, by order of the American forces, these poor people were forcibly sent back to Russia. Most of them objected. When they found out what it was, there was hardship and crying and begging. They did not want to go back to Russia. The same thing happened in Mauthausen. And I know that Colonel Seibel was very, very distressed that he received order, which he said his conscience normally would not have allowed him to do, but he was an officer and he had to obey. He had to line up all the Soviet prisoners who were still in the concentration camp Mauthausen and send them back. The Russians, who were not far from Mauthausen, came and on foot brought all the Russian soldiers back to their occupied area. In the meantime, after this disastrous action of my translating, I was asked to accompany a high-ranking officer of the SS, of the United States, to a place called Schloss Weinberg, which was a castle in Austria, not far from Linz and not far from Mauthausen, but it was in the Soviet-occupied part of Austria. I was sent there as interpreter. The Americans offered me as an interpreter for the Americans. I stayed for about 2 or 3 nights in the castle, a beautiful castle with lovely surroundings. I was very well fed, very well looked after, and very well respected by the Soviet soldiers who were there. I was still in my striped uniform, which I did not take off for security reasons, also among the post-war, immediately post-war area, to prove that I was a prisoner. And it was a demarcation conference. The American officer brought me in, introduced me, and the opposing part, commander was General Margilev, General Margilev. When I was introduced, he asked me of what nationality I was, why I spoke Russian, why I spoke English, and then immediately said he would not accept me as an interpreter. They will have their own. What happened, they did not have interpreters who spoke English. They had one who spoke German, and the Americans had to have a German who translated it into English. But I was not accepted by the Soviets as an interpreter. So I was sent back to Mauthausen. Now, after that, when we returned in a convoy...
Could I just ask you a difficult question about numbers? Was the proportion of Soviet citizens who didn't want to go back large or small?
Tremendous, tremendous. I remember that the majority would never have gone back. And when I spoke to them in Russian, they said, look, we fought for our country, but we fought against the Nazis. We didn't fight for the communists. But they were afraid because so many of them were so-called commissars who were watching and listening what they were saying. So the Soviet prisoners were extremely careful what they were saying. I recall that most Ukrainians were the ones who were tremendously opposed of going back. Some of the Russians wanted to go back, hoping that, of course, they would rejoin their families. It was very hard for some of them, even if they wanted to stay in the West, to leave their families behind. But I know they did not want to go back.
So do you think that those who did not want to go back were mainly people who declined to do so because of anti-communist feeling or because they had compromised themselves with the Germans?
No, these people did not compromise them. They were actually forces which were taken as prisoners of war. They were not the ones. There was a different type of Russians who escaped and who joined the Nazis, who joined the Germans and fought against the communists for nationalistic reasons. These were not. These were the ones, our prisoners, were the ones who were in the forces of the Soviet Union, were either taken prisoners or they were the ones who were asked on forced labor and then imprisoned in Mauthausen. But they were not the Vlasak fighters who in other parts of the world or of Europe were sent back to Russia. May I only say in this context that as far as we know, the former prisoners, we have our head office, we have our organization, that regretfully many of those whom we knew in Mauthausen as prisoners, when they arrived in Russia, they were sent for an automatic 10-year imprisonment to Siberia. The verdict was that they were taken prisoners. They were not supposed to have, they should have preferred to die than be taken prisoners by the Nazis. And a very amusing incident that after the war we formed a Comité International de Mauthausen, International Committee of Former Prisoners, representing different countries, so practically every country of the prisoners who were in the camp. We had difficulties of getting a Russian representative. Finally, they found a man who was in Mauthausen, and I actually met him during one of my visits for the reunion at the camp after the war. When I met him privately, he told me that he was for 2 years as a prisoner of the Nazis in Mauthausen, and then for 10 years in hard labor in Siberia, and he was selected to represent the Soviet Union during the meetings of the former prisoners of Mauthausen. When I returned to Czechoslovakia, we returned the Czech prisoners in a convoy of several trucks or lorries. I think about 600. I'm not quite sure. I could look it up. 600 returned out of about 4,800 prisoners in Mauthausen who returned alive. I finished finally my degree, which was interrupted when the universities were closed. I was a lawyer. I finished all my state examinations, but before I got my graduation as a doctor of law, the Nazis closed the university. So it was a formal after the war when I received my degree at the Charles University in Prague. Soon afterwards, I was approached by the US representatives in Czechoslovakia, who were probably told about my activities through the 11th Armored Division by Colonel Seibel, that they would like to see me. When I met them in Prague, I was asked to go together with several selected Czech witnesses to Nuremberg, as witnesses, not at the trial itself, but as witnesses against the Nazis, SS, who were caught after the war and imprisoned in the former concentration camp Mauthausen, concentration camp Dachau. I went to Nuremberg, and from there we were taken. There were about eight of us from Czechoslovakia. We were sent to Dachau, where we had a special house at our disposal. We had special table of witnesses in the officers' mess, and we were asked to identify the prisoners. They showed us lists of names, and if we found some names we knew, we could ask them for interviews, which we did occasionally, and we pinpointed several really big war criminals from the concentration camp Mauthausen. While going over the list, I noticed the name of Klein Günther, whom I knew very well during the camp, because he was the one, as I mentioned previously during the interview, who murdered prisoners by injections of gasoline into the heart. I immediately went to the American representative, told him the story, and asked him to see the man. I actually saw him. I recognized him immediately. He acted very subduedly and very nonchalantly, and when he was asked by the others to identify himself and tell the representatives of the U.S. judicial what he was and where he was during the war, he said his name was Klein Günther. He said the name, but he was just an ordinary SS who was never any close to any concentration camp. When he was asked whether he was in Mauthausen, where is it? He asked. He completely said, I have no idea. I was just caught. I didn't want to know. I had nothing to do with it. I was just an ordinary under officer. You know, I had nothing to do with anything. Well, I knew that he was lying. So I told the representative of the SS judicial there that I would like to bring him to court. Well, the court actually happened there. He was asked, and I was asked to tell the story. Like at every court, the United States representatives had the prosecutor and they had a lawyer who was defending a defendant, who was defending the defendant, who tried to find out every detail which would benefit the judicially, which would benefit the accused. Then in front of Klein Günther, I told the story and described how he killed the prisoners. The American officer who was defending Klein Günther asked me, what date was it? What you saw. Who else saw it? Well, I told him nobody else saw it, because it was only Klein Günther and myself who was ordered to brought the unfortunate prisoners there. He said, well, there wasn't anybody who was around. I said, no. I said, those who, because there were others who saw the same thing from other barracks, but they all were either killed or disappeared and they don't exist anymore. I'm the only one who is alive. Well, the American defendant, the man who defended Kleingunter, asked me, well, on what date did you see them? I said, I'm sorry, after so many years, even then, after the war, it was a few years. No, that was not that many. But we did not have calendars in the camp, and I certainly do not remember the actual date. Then he said, well, at what time of the day it was? I tried to recall, but I just couldn't. And instead of saying or guessing, I said, I'm sorry, I don't recall at what time of the day it was. And the officer defendant turned to the prosecutor and said, how can you believe a man who doesn't even know the time of the day? Dismissed. And the man went free.
One thing that we haven't mentioned, going back to Mauthausen, is the question of medical experimentation on inmates. Do you have any first-hand evidence that that went on?
Yes, I do. I would like to mention that at certain times we were so-called guinea pigs for the Nazis to find out what injections could be used for the soldiers at the front with the safety. In that case, they tried them first on us, on certain groups of prisoners, and watched the effects, especially with those who were really weak and tired and hungry, so that they would be sure that these injections wouldn't harm their soldiers if these injections would be used. I remember that there was an SS Sturmbannführer, Dr. Karl Josef Gross, who started in February 1943 a series of tests on prisoners, and these tests lasted till about May. We were selected, they were about over 100 prisoners. We were kept separately in barracks and we were given certain injections. Some of them were combinations. I recall that we had shots against typhus and paratyphus, A and B, then typhus tetanus, and typhus, paratyphus, A and B, and cholera combinations.